Welcome to Ideas and Issues. This is your host, Hila Follett. On our show this morning, I'm talking to Gary Sicco, Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Gary, glad to have you with us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be with you.
What we're going to do today is to talk about the implications of evolutionary theory. When people think about evolution, they think primarily about it as a biological theory, and so maybe that's a reasonable place to begin. Why is evolution the current best theory of the nature and complexity of biological organisms?
Well, I think, first of all, you need to make a distinction between evolution as sort of a fact that organisms over time change. And you can look at the fossil record and see that. You can actually see it in real time when you look at things like microorganisms as they develop resistance. So evolution just means change over time. Darwin called it descent with modification. So evolution happens. We've seen it in the past. We see it happening now. I guess the better question is, why is Darwin's theory of natural selection the best theory to explain the fact of biological evolution? Is that how I should go on that? Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay. First of all, you want to start with, what is there to explain? What are we interested in here? And if you were to look at, certainly, animals, you see that they're quite remarkably organized. They are put together in a way that suggests they've been designed to survive, to take in food, to reproduce, and these types of things. And you can use the term for that type of complex organization, adaptive complexity. So when you see something like that, first of all, you say, well, that's a bit unusual. That just didn't happen for no reason. And you're led to come up with some type of an explanation. So the Reverend Paley, before the time of Darwin, we'd use the example of coming across a watch in a field, and you'd look at this watch and you'd say, well, it keeps time, all the gears fit together, it must have had a designer or a maker. And the first way of explaining whether it would be a watch from nowhere organisms would be that someone or something created it in some way. So you could call that a providential explanation, that there was a watchmaker, as Paley would say. And he would then extend that to say that there would be a creator, a supreme being that created organisms. That is a religious theory, and there's really nothing in natural selection to dispute ultimately being a god or a creator, but it relies on supernatural miracles, if you will. So scientists are interested in more naturalistic explanations, and there are two other ways of looking at something like an organism. And one way, the second way, is to recognize that organisms change over time, and so you have evolution going on, but then the theory being that some type of instructive process occurs by which the environment causes a change in the animal, in the organism, and that change is then passed down to the descendants. So this is called the inheritance of acquired characters or characteristics, and this is also referred to as Lamarckian theory from Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who first came up with this theory. So this is an instructionist, if you will, theory, because it suggests that the environment changes organisms, or the organism itself changes in response to the environment. The classic example is animals stretching their necks to reach leaves at the top of the tree, and it makes their necks a little larger, and their offspring have longer necks, and after many generations you get a giraffe. The problem with that theory is that it doesn't work. Acquired characteristics are not passed on to offspring. Typically not. There are some exceptions to that at the micro level, but if you go and work out in a gym and make big muscle for yourself, your kids are not going to be naturally have more developed muscles. Actually, they did experiments where they would chop the tails off rats and see what happened to their offspring, and the tails didn't get any shorter. So that doesn't work in terms of evolution. What Darwin came up with, and Wallace as well, 20 years later, although before Darwin had published the theory, was this notion of selection, and that evolution occurs because there is variation in organisms. And you see that, certainly when you look at people, the variation is very striking. But I imagine if you were a squirrel looking at other squirrels, you'd see lots of differences there, which we really don't see. But there is variation in organisms. And certain of these variations lend the organism or the animal to be more successful than others in surviving and ultimately reproducing. And this type of natural selection then is an appealing explanation because it doesn't require any type of miracle, supernatural explanations. The fossil record is very consistent with it. We see it happening before our eyes, whether you go to the Galapagos Islands, as the Peter and Rosemary Grant have done over many years to look at the finches there changing in response to climatic changes. We see it in microorganisms when we try to keep ahead of diseases. Bacteria keep developing resistance, and insects as well, to the pesticides that we use. So we see it happening. And so right now, Darwin's theory, at least the part that has to do with variation and selection, is really the only reasonable theory for explaining evolution or biological evolution.
Okay, let me see if this is right. There, you might even make three different distinctions between talk about evolution. The first you call evolution as a fact, the fact that organisms do change and they change over time. Second is a somewhat more theoretical stance, namely the theory of natural selection is a way of explaining how evolution occurs, in particular the evolution of species. And the second, you say, is pretty much uncontentious within the biological community. The third may be more contentious, differences about the exact way selection works, details of whether natural selection is supplemented by other mechanisms, that sort of thing. Is that roughly right?
Well, the disagreement is in some of the details about variation and selection. I guess one of the biggest debates is, you know, to what extent is evolution leads to increased complexity, or whether there's lots of drift going on. And so there may be some characteristics in which we vary. A lot of the DNA that we have is junk DNA, doesn't really do anything. And so there's this notion of genetic drift that a lot of the changes may not be functional. But I think we should make a distinction. What I'm interested in is not just evolution or change, but I'm specifically interested in changes where you have an increase in adaptive complexity, when you have this adaptation that is really quite remarkable to see, that is clearly not just neutral or adrifting. And to explain that type of change, the basic notion of variation and selection really has no competitors at all.
Okay, could you give one quick example of how this might work? How some sort of organism might have gone from having no trait or very simple trait to having a much more complex one? Just well, maybe one quick example, and then we'll move on to some of your other points.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could use the example of the finches in the Galapagos Islands that are separated from each other. They originally came from one species on the mainland of South America, and usually you need some type of isolation. So you have a population or subpopulation that is isolated from another. And what you have then is some changes. So on one particular island, for example, may be much drier, and the seeds are heavier and harder to crack. And so the finches on that particular island would develop heavier, more solid beaks to allow them to crack these larger seeds and nuts. On other islands, there may be more insects available, and they may be gotten by digging into plants, so they may have more slender shark beaks. So that's sort of an example at a more superficial level, but you can come up with, and you do actually find in the fossil record, transitions between things like fossils and birds. And you have one of the things that helps this along is that you may have an initial change that is not actually related to the ultimate use of an organ. So, for example, wings on insects and birds are thought now to have originally developed just for thermal regulation, ways of cooling off the bodies and allowing them to warm up more quickly, and only later did they become adapted for flight. And so that's another example how you can have a change in function of an organ, and it sort of explains, you know, what good is half a wing if it doesn't allow you to fly? Well, the answer is that it's probably being used for something else originally, and later on it will adapt a new function.
Let's move now in a somewhat different direction. I mean, your view in your book, Without Miracles, which is available, and I think you mentioned it was also available, or a great deal of it was available on the web, if anyone
right.
wanted to locate it. And if they did, they should look up your name, which is spelled C-Z, IKO, correct?
Right. Okay. And along with the title Without Miracles, they should be able to find it on any search engine.
Part of the argument there is that the idea of natural selection, or what you sometimes there call universal selectionism, is capable of explaining a great deal more than the emergence of complex biological organisms. Could you generally describe what you have in mind, and then we can look at the details later on in the show?
Right. Okay. Well, there is lots of examples, and this actually is where I'm a bit even more interested, because I'm not a biologist. I'm in education. I'm interested in how it's possible for people to develop new skills and learn new knowledge. And so that's sort of my angle. And I was attracted to the notion of variation of selection, because it could explain, in terms of evolution, how organisms became, in a sense, knowledgeable about their environment. And as I started poking around in different areas, I found that this mechanism of variation selection was showing up in lots of different areas. One nice example is the immune system. It used to be thought that you were born with all of the antibodies that you would ever need to fight diseases and pathogens. Then it was found that this isn't really the case, that there are new antibodies created. Back at the turn of the century, they did research on this. And then it was thought that, well, what goes on is that when your body is exposed to a pathogen in some way, your immune system uses that as sort of a type of cookie cutter to create antibodies that will fit it. And then it was found that that theory didn't explain how you develop new antibodies. And in fact, they came up with a very similar explanation to variation selection, or a type of Darwinian explanation, in which your body or your immune system creates, just randomly mutates genes on a certain portion of chromosomes in creating antibodies. And so it's creating a whole variety of antibodies. Most of them will never be used, but a few of those will match with a virus or a bacterium. And when it matches, those particular antibodies reproduce, and they mutate some more. And so you have a variation in selection actually going on within your body. And if that process is disrupted, you don't last very long. You will actually get a disease that you are not able to recover from. Of course, the AIDS virus is one that disrupts that particular process. So that's another biological example, but it's interesting because it shows the process of variation selection going on within the lifetime or within the organism, and not just among organisms over geological time. And if you were to then go beyond that and into other areas such as, well, something like science and technology. I mean, right now you're using, you probably have a computer in front of you. You're using equipment to record and to transmit this this program. How did that come about? I mean, how does technology change? And many writers, historians, psychologists, philosophers have actually been using the Darwinian model to explain science and technology. How do computers get better and smaller and faster? It's because people have ideas. They generate variations of ideas, some of which they will just try out in their brain. Others they will try out maybe on a computer using some type of a virtual reality or a computer circuit simulation program. But you don't know ahead of time what's going to work. And so you have lots of ideas. You have brainstorming, particularly if you have lots of people working on a particular idea. And you test them out. You test them out by trying to build new machines, new scientific theories, and seeing if they work, seeing if they work better than the old ones, keeping them if they do, throwing them out if they don't. And so in the area of philosophy, for example, Karl Popper perhaps is the most well-known advocate of this particular way of looking at the evolution of science. And so in my area, for example, education, this would suggest that if you want students to learn new skills and knowledge, that you need to provide an environment where they can try things out, become active, be free, allow them to be free so that they can try new things, but you don't want them to hurt themselves if it doesn't work, so you use a bit of a safety net in a certain way. But you also have to have an environment that's responsive, and so that the things that aren't very good are eliminated, the particular skills or knowledge they're trying out, and the better ones are retained, at least tentatively, until something better comes along. So the basic notion of variation and selection not only explains certain phenomena, such as biological evolution, the immune system, actually the development of the brain and synapses and neurons there's something that people call neural Darwinism going on in your brain. So it explains these types of advances in knowledges or changes in adaptive complexity. But it can actually be used as a tool to create new forms of knowledge and new technologies. And so you have people actually now using the Darwinian process to create computer programs. We recently had a conference here on this campus on what's called genetic programming or genetic algorithms, whereby you have a particular problem you want to solve. You come up with a computer program or a population of computer programs which vary in different ways, and you actually test out these programs, select the best ones, take the two best, allow them to mate and actually recombine in a genetic way their genes, if you will. They're actually having sex on the computer. They're having offspring, and then you test out their offspring in terms of how well they can solve a particular problem. And so this is a sort of a very exciting development in the field of computers and engineering, is actually using this process of variation and selection. Also, for the development of drugs, you have things going on called combinatorial chemistry, which also does something similar. It varies the molecules and tests out the resulting compounds for certain characteristics, and then selecting those and recombining them and actually doing an artificial type of variation and selection.
Okay, so the primary driving model of selectionism is the idea that there are variations that are tried and then those that work are retained.
Right.
And one of the things that happens, though, is that once you retain the ones that work, that changes changes the baseline of what the variation will be. If, for example, you're trying to build a new generation computer, you don't go back
right
to the very beginnings of computers. You
right
begin with where we are in computers and then try variations on those to try to make them better.
That's right. I mean, you could, maybe the better term is to actually say cumulative variation and selection.
Okay.
And not just a one-shot deal. So that's right. You base things upon what have worked in the past, and you change those in certain ways and try out modifications or variations of those, and you continue in that way. That can lead you into trouble, too. I mean, you can get into dead ends that way. That happens to organisms all the time because they become extinct, particularly with a rapidly changing environment now as man fiddles with it. So, I mean, there's a problem with that because it's not guaranteed to lead you always to success. But this is one of the things that the engineers in particular are interested in, is how to get out of those blind alleys and to recover and maybe go back a little bit. And they actually will use mutation rate as a way of backtracking a bit and trying previous solutions and paths that were discarded too soon.
Okay, in fact, you used a word there I think it's very important for this account, and that's the environment. That what matters is not just variation and selection. The selection always occurs within an environment, and what's satisfactory selection in one environment might not be in another.
That's right.
And that's, of course, going to have implications for understanding of education as well. Now, you've primarily given some examples. Could you talk a little bit more about the way in which this model is used in understanding animal and human behavior?
Sure. Well, Darwin wrote a little bit about that way back in the last century. And for a number of reasons, it didn't really catch on into psychology until quite a bit later on with ethologists, people like Conrad Lorenz and Tinbergen and others, who started looking at animal behavior and saying, well, if we understand animals as having certain physical characteristics and traits which evolve over time and are adaptive in certain ways, wings for flight and feathers for warmth, if you're thinking of geese now, because that's what Conrad Lorenz worked with a lot. Well, if you can use evolution to explain these structural changes, adaptations, well, then what about behavior itself? And so he started looking at what he would call species-specific behaviors and seeing how these would be inherited and modified and passed on, just as any other particular characteristic. So animals certainly have certain preferences in what they eat, where they live, how they get around, and these particular behaviors can be explained to a large extent from a Darwinian perspective, is that if you look at these behaviors, or the results actually of the behaviors, you can see that, for the most part, that they are useful in, number one, keeping the animal alive, number two, allowing it to find mates and reproduce, and then in some cases, depending upon the animal, actually caring for the young and helping the young to survive and become mature and to reproduce itself. So he started that. You had E.O. Wilson, I guess it was in the 60s, who started thinking about applying this to humans. I mean, others did as well, but his book, I think it was 65, Sociobiology, he's perhaps one of the most well-known entomologists, experts in ant behavior, and he came up with what he calls sociobiology, which, did I get that right? Is that the term? I think so.
Yeah, that's it.
Sociobiology, mm-hmm. That's what the title of the book was.
Right.
And he had a final chapter where he said, well, you know, we could explain human behavior through an evolutionary perspective as well. And that caused him lots of trouble, made him quite visible in the academic community. A lot of people came down on him and said, well, this suggests that human behavior then is, you know, determined by our genes, genetic determination, all these types of things, which really isn't the case, although it can be seen in that way if you're not careful. But he really didn't have a lot of data at that point. And that has changed over the last 10, 15 years or so. And a bunch of psychologists who call themselves now evolutionary psychologists have been collecting data along these lines and looking at human behavior. I mean, certainly in animal behavior, if you pick up a book, I have a text here by a fellow called Alcott, Animal Behavior, and if you look at any textbook on animal behavior, just about any of them will explain animal behavior from an evolutionary perspective. I mean, it's been a very productive way of understanding what's going on as to the ultimate origins of certain types of behaviors. Even things that seem very puzzling at first, when you start looking at it more closely, I mean, why does a certain gazelle, when the lion is coming after the herd, why does he stop and jump high up into the sky and do this little jumping act? You know, it would seem to slow him down instead of getting out of there, and then you find out that he's displaying the fact that he's really fast and fit. Don't waste your time chasing me, and the lions tend not to chase those particular gazelles. So even animal behaviors that are quite puzzling, many of them have been explained from an evolutionary perspective. When you look at human behavior, things are more complex because we can, you know, decide to do things and not do other things for reasons that are really quite complex, but nonetheless you will find among humans in all societies certain preferences, behaviors that lead to certain results, which can be also explained from an evolutionary perspective. And I suppose the book that maybe made this most popular was a couple years ago by Robert Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, called The Moral Animal, and that made a bit of a splash, and he does a pretty good job of at least introducing some of the ideas of evolutionary psychology. And there's also a recent textbook that I came across that's pretty good at this, called Evolutionary Psychology by David Buss, B-U-S-S, I believe he's at Texas. So, I mean, I could give you a number of examples of certain human preferences that can be explained from an evolutionary perspective if that's where you want to go now or if you have some other questions.
Well, I think that we've got about 4.5 minutes left. I think it might be interesting if you could come up with one example of human behavior and then maybe follow up on the heels, because the one thing you talked about a moment ago is that humans can choose. Humans can make fairly complex choices. And perhaps talk about the way in which evolution might, natural selection might be used to explain the nature of choice.
Okay, well, let me maybe give you two quick examples. One is something as simple as food preferences. Okay, now humans have preference for certain types of food. Animals will eat certain things that we wouldn't even think of eating, but we tend to like things that have fat in them, sugar, to some extent protein and salt. These were the types of things that were really in scarce supply when we were evolving as a species. So if you had a good hunt and you brought down an animal and you would sort of pig out on that because you didn't know when you were going to eat again. The problem is now is in the 20th century, many people, including most Americans, have unlimited access to fat, sugar, and salt. And what do? We overindulge, and this is not healthy anymore. So you have something like a food preference. Let me make one other quick example, sex differences in mating. Females, human females, are more choosy in who they will mate with. Males, less so. And this can be explained. In fact, you can look through the animal kingdom and find the similarity. Males compete with each other for access to mates. They're more easily sexually aroused. And this can be explained in terms of females usually having a much greater investment in their offspring. A human female is pregnant for 9 months and has to provide nourishment for the baby, and there's a much greater investment there than a male who can sow his wild oats, as you say. So you find differences in mate choice and mating behavior that cuts right through the animal kingdom. It's really not just male and female, because there are some male species that have a greater investment, like seahorses, and they're actually more choosy than their female counterparts, because the males actually become pregnant, not the females. So you have differences. You have these certain food preferences evolving. You also have certain differences in sexual behavior. What becomes complicated about humans is that, and this is one of the reasons you could say that it's useful to know about these things, because we as humans can say, okay, I have a preference for eating certain things, but I can understand where that came from. I can also understand that now it's not good for me to eat too much fat or sugar, and I can, or salt, and I can cut back on my intake of those. That bacon may always smell good. I can't change that. That's part of my biological heritage. But I can decide not to eat it. And the same thing in terms of sexual behavior. Men understanding, for example, that they have this, they're easily turned on, they have a desire for sexual variety, they could be cheating on their spouses and their long-term mates. They can say, oh, I understand why I have these feelings. I understand where that comes from. But then I can decide not to act on those, or not to put myself in situations where I might be tempted to engage in a relationship with someone other than my wife or my long-term mate. So those are two examples of certain preferences or sex differences that can be explained in terms of evolution, and also how the knowledge of those preferences can be used in a sense to change our behavior, in some ways going against our evolutionary legacy, which is a bit of a paradox, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, let me ask you real quickly. We're about out of time. We've only got a minute left. But what you gave is an example of knowledge, where knowledge informs choice. Would it be fair to say that the ability to choose itself is one that evolves, that we make choices, we make bad choices, and we make good ones, and in light of that, we may learn to make better ones?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is part of the cognitive side of evolution, the type of mental or cognitive Darwinism, if you will, that goes on. We never actually know for certain if a particular choice or course of action is going to turn out right. But what we do is base our current actions and decisions on what's happened in the past, and go with that. Those people who perhaps are more risky and will try new things will come up with perhaps more creative solutions and new inventions, ways of living, or certain products. So this continuing variation selection is certainly part of our mental capacity, which I think humans have to a far greater extent than any other species. Just the notion of being able to consider the possible consequences of various actions. So you can call this a type of substitute or vicarious variation selection, using our brains as a type of virtual reality, where we don't actually have to follow through actions, but we can think about them and make our decisions before we act. Of course, there's no knowing ahead of time for sure if something's going to turn out as you expect, but we accumulate our knowledge in this very way.
Okay, we're going to have to cut it. We're a little bit over right now. Thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Gary Dziko, Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. This is Hugh LaFollette, Friday's Missions. Good day.